Welcome to STEM Spots, a weekly science review produced in cooperation with the Missouri State University Department of Physics, Astronomy, and Material Science.
Hi, this is Dave Cornielsen, and you're listening to the web edition of STEM Spots. With me in the studio today is Dr. Adam Sobel. He's a professor of applied physics and applied mathematics and of earth and environmental sciences at Columbia University in New York City. Thanks for stopping by, Adam.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Now, Adam, you were actually a climate scientist. I've had some people on talking about climate science who are not actually in that category. And so can you give us the basics of climate modeling, sort of lead us through it?
Sure. I mean, the first thing that's important to say is that climate science and climate modeling are not one and the same. Climate modeling is a part of climate science. So just to understand the climate, we use observations, historical and even paleo, you know, from the geological record to go further back in time. And we use theory, basic principles of physics, just like you use in other areas of physics. But climate models are an important part of it. And what the climate models do is they take the equations of physics that describe how the atmosphere and the ocean move, and they approximate them on the computer as best we can, and they integrate them forward in time. So there, it's like a virtual world where we're making the atmosphere and ocean and the other parts of the climate system, the sea ice, the land, evolve forward using the real laws of physics as best as we can approximate them. And they are, in that sense, really the same in principle and even in many cases in the actual computer code to the weather models that predict our weather, that make our weather forecasts every day, that have been getting better and better for decades. It's just that the climate models are solving a different problem, where instead of running for a couple of weeks forward or even just a few days, they're running years and decades and centuries forward. And on those timescales, you can't predict the actual weather far in time. You can only do that about 2 weeks. You're predicting the sort of fluctuations over longer terms and the long-term trends. But the principle is the same. You're taking the laws of physics, putting them on a computer, and trying to approximate the behavior of the real system. And that's in the most comprehensive way that current science allows us to do.
So let's ask a couple of questions about that. First of all, how do you sort of check? I think you go backwards in time. That's the first question. And the second question, if from your own perspective, what's the hardest part? I understand you jam the physics in there and you've got to get the physics correct. What's the trickiest part of that? What do you find is the trickiest part of making the model have everything it needs in it? So those two questions.
Right. So how do you check? Yeah, the only way ultimately to check is against observations, but there's a lot of different ways of doing that. With weather, of course, you're checking every day. I mean, you make a weather forecast and you look at what the weather happened and you see what the errors are. And over a year, you get many, many, many forecasts and you can check and you make it slowly better. With climate forecasts, it's harder because you're predicting over longer periods of time. You don't have as much sample. And we do seasonal predictions year to year. We predict like is next, you know, winter or summer going to be a little warmer or cooler than average, and we can evaluate those predictions. But for actual long-range climate predictions, like for global warming, that's more difficult because, of course, we're predicting the long-term future, and it's going to be a long time till we have the observations. But we do have historical observations, and not only can we check retrospectively, but since climate models have been around now since really the 70s, 80s, there have been predictions made over all that time, and we can look at how they've done, and they've done surprisingly well. The rates of warming predicted by models in the 80s were held up pretty well. Even those models were very primitive compared to the ones we have today. So and you can also look at finer scale details. When the model predicts the differences in climate between one region and another, does it get those right? Does it have the right structure of how the sea surface temperature varies or where the jet stream is or all those kinds of things? So that's, check compared to observations by as many different metrics on as many different timescales and space scales as we can. In terms of what's the most difficult, in my view, the most difficult is what we call parameterization, which means when I say we're approximating the laws of physics on the computer as best we can, that phrase as best we can is doing a fair bit of work there. So really, the fundamental problem is resolution. So if you think about a digital camera, you know, you have only so many pixels. And if you try to take a picture of somebody's face from very far away and you don't have enough pixels, their face is going to look blocky and you're not going to really be able to tell who it is. Similarly, climate models are limited by their resolution. They're representing the atmosphere and ocean and so on in pixels, more or less, one way or the other. And so they can only resolve the features that they have enough pixels to resolve. So for example, a cloud is not really represented literally correctly in a climate model because it's too small. And so the effects of clouds, which matter a lot, have to be largely parameterized, which means that they're represented by blocks of computer code that are not exactly literally using the laws of physics because they can't, because it would take too much computer power. So how you do that is a source of huge amount of work and huge amount of effort to try to represent those underrepresented processes like clouds and some aspects of mixing and small scales in the atmosphere and ocean, and how the land surface behaves, and radiation passing through the atmosphere is also parameterized, although that's pretty accurate these days. That's probably the most difficult
thing.
Would that mean
that the thing that's holding you back, or that's holding climate modeling back, let's call it, or limiting climate modeling, would be the speed and utility of the computers? In other words, do people have things that they would add to the models and they say, man, I could really make this model better if only the computers were better? Is that true? Is that a fair statement?
That is to some extent a fair statement. We are one of the fields, you know, when digital computers were first invented, weather and climate were one of the first fields that they were used for. We are a field where any computer, no matter how big it is, you give it to us and we can use it. If you can give us a bigger one, we'll be happy with that too. Because as I mentioned, these parameterizations, the reason they're there is because you don't have enough resolution. So the more resolution you have, the less you have to parameterize, and the more you can literally use the laws of physics. Now, I don't want to say that that's the whole story. I mean, it's not like a computer can do its work without people. There's a science to representing the behavior of the climate on the computer, even given what the physical laws are. And, you know, just getting a bigger computer doesn't always give you a more accurate answer in the short term. But in the long term, more powerful computers ultimately will make the models better. And we've seen that over a decade.
Okay. And so then, so that people can understand just generally what you're looking at here, if you're going to run some sort of a model that might do something that you're interested in, how much physical time does it take to run your model? I know people that do, for example, solid state code of a certain kind called ab initio, and sometimes they'll run something that might, it might take a week or two to run on a computer. That's easily possible. So what kinds of time scales just to get data out that makes sense?
So it really very much depends on what you're doing, and of course on how big the computer is. If you're running a model for centuries and it's a coupled climate model at high resolution, then it can take a very long time, even on the biggest supercomputers there are. On the other hand, weather forecasts, you know, have to be run faster than the weather happens, and they are. So a weather model is run, you know, nowadays they're run at resolutions of 10, 20 kilometers. That's the size of the grid of those pixels, and they're run 50 times or something, you know, tens of times for model times of a couple of weeks. And that has to happen, you know, within hours. They're run every 6 hours, in, for example, the United States model. So that's, but they're only being run a couple of weeks. So if you're running a climate model and you want to do it for, you know, you want to represent the next century, then it's going to take longer. On the other hand, you might use lower resolution. So these are trade-offs, and it really depends on the amount of computer. I wish I could quote you the exact number of flops, but
that's fine. So let me ask you this. You train students. You're at a university. You've got people that come into, as you pointed out, climate modeling, which is a subset of climate science. So when you look at climate science in general, are people broken up? In other words, are there people that are the computer jocks, and then are there people over here who are experimental observation people? I mean, or are there people in between that sort of mediate between the two and make sure that they understand each other? How does the sort of general layout of people in climate science look?
Yeah, there's all of the above. There's definitely, at the big climate models are developed at national laboratories, like the Goddard Institute for Space Studies is one that's affiliated with Columbia, where I work. It's a NASA lab in Manhattan. There's the other one is in Princeton, and then at NCAR in Colorado. And those labs that develop the models do have straight up computer people to make the codes more efficient, to make the math run faster, to make them work on the big machines. There are people who specialize in the physics at making the models represent the physical laws as well as possible, and those are scientists who know a lot about the atmosphere and ocean, probably also know something about computers, but maybe not enough as much as the straight-up computer people. There are people who specialize in observations, both modern observations, you know, radar and satellite and stuff like that. A lot of the observations we use, though, are pretty routine now. For example, the radiosonde networks, the weather balloons, those are not really research anymore. Those are operational, and so those are, But then there's specialized observations like like certainly a lot of satellite work. That's that requires special skills, and there's always new satellites being developed. And then paleoclimate is a field unto itself, and that's where people look at, you know, the mud at the bottom of the ocean to see what microbes are in there, or and what isotopes of different elements, or ice core data, where you're digging up ice from Greenland and Antarctica and looking at the layers going down, or tree rings. And those are people with very special, distinct set of skills. And there are absolutely, is actually a need for boundary people who can understand these different sources of information, integrate them. And in some ways, those people's job is the most important, because we really do need a comprehensive picture of everything that's going on if we're to make sense of it.
Well, then on a related note, I know that your bachelor's degree was in physics and I think music, if I'm not mistaken. And you have a PhD in, I think, officially meteorology, if I'm right. But what's a good training? I talk to students. Sometimes they're interested in this sort of thing. I've had some students that have gone on to do it. Is physics a good basic training to get, or would it be better to be a computer science person if they thought they were going to go into climate?
Yeah, I think they're all good. I mean, it depends exactly what you want to do, but I think meteorology, yeah, that's becoming an outdated term. I don't know if there's too many PhDs called meteorology anymore. Now we'd probably say atmosphere, ocean science, or climate science, but there is more and more training in this field at the undergraduate level, but if you want to go on and do it at the graduate level and do a PhD, in my view, it's not necessarily better to start in atmosphere, ocean science. I'm, of course, biased. As you say, my undergrad degree was in physics, so I still think physics is a great training. In some ways, maybe the best, but I'm prejudiced. Computer science is absolutely critically important. We have a need for computer science. Chemistry, I mean, a lot of climate is atmospheric composition. What's the, you know, in what we call dynamics, we're studying how the atmosphere moves, but then there's what is the stuff, right? The greenhouse gases, the short-lived pollutants, the aerosols, all those, the chemistry of those is an important topic. Mathematics, you know, computational mathematics. I think all those are good backgrounds. A meteorology major is good too, as long as it's quantitative enough. I think are some students who want to go into this field because they were weather geeks when they were kids, or because kids are concerned about the climate. You know, that we have students who are very passionate about the climate as a cause, or concerned about the future, and that's great. But the ones, if you want to do the science, though, you have to be able to do a certain level of mathematics and physics, and computation. And I think it's important to recognize whatever you do, you need that quantitative background in this field.
I agree completely. Now you have this, you've painted this picture where you have this large, loose coalition of all sorts of people, computer science people, mathematical modelers, physicists, people that are out in the field taking all kinds of data from paleo data to modern data and so forth. And so now this consensus gets built up, and I think people generally know this, but talk about the parts of the models that have sort of, or the parts of climate science view of the models that has become consensus, and the parts of it that are still open to serious discussion, and there's a lot of variability.
Yeah. So the consensus is that the climate is warming due to human activity, especially emissions of greenhouse gases, carbon dioxide, methane, and a few others. And we know that's happening because we see it happening. Basic physics of greenhouse gases in the climate system tells us it should happen, and the climate models tell us it should happen. So we know the planet's warming because of the gases we've put up there. We know roughly how fast it's warming, although exactly how fast, there's definitely still disagreement. And that's because over the historical record, we know how fast it's warmed, but you have to separate out the natural variability part from the anthropogenic part. We actually think that the current evidence strongly indicates that actually human activity is responsible for more than 100% of the warming we've seen in the last few decades. And how that makes sense is that it means natural factors have actually would have cooled the climate otherwise, we've warmed more. So the very big picture, some other gross facts about it, like why the fact that the pole is warming more strongly than the equator, that's why we have strong Arctic sea ice melting. The gross structure of it, the fact that the stratosphere is cooling while the troposphere where we live is warming, we understand that. And a lot of other features at the very largest scales where we have gross agreement. There's a huge number of things we disagree on, especially when you get more quantitative. So, for example, exactly the regional structure of warming, which parts of the Earth, as the climate warms, we'll see more rain or less rain, you know, and the smaller scale you get, the trickier that gets. Some kinds of extreme events we understand very well. So for example, we know that heat waves are getting more severe and more frequent, and that's simple because it's warmer. So if a heat wave is just being hotter than some temperature for some period of time, of course, that's going to happen more. We understand that. And then there's some, and then we also, with a little less confidence, we know that heavy rain events are getting heavier because there's more water vapor in the atmosphere. And the fact that there's more water vapor in the atmosphere when it's warmer is something we understand very well. Basic physics says this should happen. Climate model says it should happen, and it's observed to happen. But then as you get down to some other kinds of extreme events, hurricanes, which I study, we agree about some things, like they're producing more rain and they are getting stronger in terms of their winds. But whether there's more or fewer of them, we really don't know. We haven't seen really strong trends globally, and models give us conflicting answers, and we don't have a simple theory for it. And then severe convection, things like tornadoes, there's even more uncertainty. So I think, you know, there's a lot of details that we are still studying and arguing over and debating. And then there's a big picture, you know, so when people say the science is settled or it's not, that's not a, you know, you have to be a little more precise than that. It's not as though, you know, climate scientists all agree to some, you know, some slate of views. It's just that over many years of debate, the big picture has been settled, partly because the model's gotten better, our understanding's gotten better, but also we've been watching the climate system get warmer and warmer over the last, you know, 25 years since I've been in the field. It's kept going in the same direction.
Well, you know, on a comment about that is that people many times don't really understand the progress of science. If you've read about thermoscience, which of course was developed primarily in the 1700s and 1800s, and you think about something as simple as the term energy, there was a debate for many, many years between different groups as to what they actually meant when they said the word energy. So if right. something like that can be debated for a long time, then obviously working out something as complex as climate predictions is going to take some time. When you talk about extreme events and the interaction between dynamics and other kinds of things, what other kinds of things are you looking at? So talk about how you use statistical methods to try to also look at climate modeling and climate science.
Right. So for any kind of prediction that we make in climate science, there's generally two classes of predictions you can make. You can make dynamical predictions, and that's using the models like what we've been describing. I mean, they're really taking the laws of physics to make a prediction, solving a bunch of partial differential equations that represent the conservation of mass, momentum, energy that you just described. Then there are statistical predictions, which are basically the kind of predictions that are done in other areas of science. So for example, if you look at models that are used to predict elections, like if you follow the models that are in the newspapers that are trying to forecast elections based on polls, those are statistical models. In other words, they're models that have looked at how polls that were taken in the past related to the outcomes that happened in the past, and then they're looking at the polls today, and then they derive some rules from that, but they're not based on any a priori science. They're based on looking at past performance, basically, and then they take the current polls and say, well, okay, if you use those same rules today, what would it predict? Same for baseball games or the stock market. All those are statistical models, and you can do that kind of modeling for climate too. You can say, well, in the past, when the climate did this in November, then what did it do in December and January after that? I mean, it's a little more detailed than that, but that's essentially what statistical models do. And those are still used, not really for weather forecasting, but for a seasonal climate prediction where we're predicting months ahead the average state of the atmosphere. Statistical models are still in use for things like El Nino. And for extreme events, you can use them too. So that's what we do. We take, in our own work, my colleagues and I at Columbia have a statistical dynamical model that where we want to predict hurricane, not predict, we want to look at the risk of hurricane activity under a changing climate. And because there, every other way of doing it has various uncertainties, we have a particular approach where we look at how climate and hurricanes were related in the past. So when a hurricane developed, what climate state was it in locally? And how, looking over many hurricanes, can we get some rules with as much physics as we can put in, but also some empiricism about how the hurricane evolved based on what climate it was in. And then from those rules, we can give it a climate model's projection of the future climate and have it tell us something about the hurricanes. Now, of course, the climate model will also produce its own hurricanes, but the resolution in general isn't good enough for them to be very good. So this is kind of hybrid approach that we use for looking at risk, and it's sort of an extension of approaches that are used in the insurance industry, actually, where hurricane risk is a terribly important
Right, obviously. So let me ask you one last question, which is, you've actually been called to testify at Congress on some of these things. What kinds of things do you think, from your own experience, maybe you can mention that a little bit, do you think that people really need to consider? What are political figures trying to understand? Do they have really an eye for the future? Are they looking big picture? Or are they more interested in these other kinds of things like extreme events and worries about spending money? From your own perspective, if you could, since you've been called to testify before.
Right. I mean, of course, the political scene in the United States is highly polarized, and there's two parties, and I think their views on climate are quite different. But although, honestly, I think, so it's perceived, climate is perceived as being something that Democrats are more worried about. I think, in fact, there are quite a few Republicans who are worried about it, too, although they're a little more afraid to talk about it. But I think politicians are worried about what happens on their watch. They're worried about their constituents. So when we see extreme weather events happening, leaders that represent those states have to be concerned about it. And if it's something that's happening more frequently or more severely, then they want to know, you know, what the facts are and what the risks are and what might be done about it. I think, you know, the challenge with climate has been historically that it's perceived as a long-term problem. And so many leaders could think, well, it's sort of, I don't need to think about it on my watch. I've got more urgent things, the economy and so on. But I think that's changed especially because of the youth movement, where you have kids who are really saying, you know, this is our future and we've got to do something about it. And I do think that's starting to change, has already started to change the dialogue. And you see more seriousness now, for example, from the Biden administration on climate than any past presidential administration has shown before.
So I'm going to finish up with this simple question, and I think I understand what it means to myself. What motivates you? In other words, when you think about scientists, when I think about scientists and I think about what motivated me to do what it is that I supposedly do, it's different than what I think a lot of average people think. They think that it's search for truth / whatever. I mean, I'm fundamentally curious, and how I found myself doing condensed matter surface physics is a long and tortuous thing. So would you say you got into this because of some big picture, or did you get into it as the way people usually get into fields where you're very interested in it and you find yourself in it and one day you wake up and you're a climate scientist?
I'll tell you the actual story. As you said, and when I was in college, I studied physics and music. And the first couple of years, I wanted to be a musician. And then after a couple of years, that wasn't working out so great. And I decided to go back and study physics. But having been out in the workforce a few years, I figured I better think about what kind of physics I want to do. And because some are related to industry, some are more theoretical, et cetera. And my wife, we weren't married yet, but she was my girlfriend at the time. She was an environmental science person, and she said, if I had a physics background like you, I would study meteorology and do global warming. Now, this was in the early 90s. Not too many people were.
That's
about this,
prescient.
Right? Yeah, and my first thought was, oh, that's boring. I mean, I was convinced by the science of global warming as much as I knew about it, but it didn't seem exciting to me because, like you, I mean, I studied quantum mechanics and relativity, and that seemed, those sort of mental puzzles seemed really fascinating, and global warming seemed kind of boring, like you put more carbon, it gets warmer, okay. But it just didn't seem like that exciting to me. But the more I learned about the field, I really liked fluid dynamics. The fact that I was fascinated by watching flowing rivers, and the physics of that seemed fascinating. And I liked the computer simulation. I wasn't that great in the lab, and I liked the idea that you could have sort of virtual world and experiment on the computer just using the mathematical laws. That seemed fascinating to me. So I got interested in the field. Actually, the first 10 or so years I was in the field, I didn't study climate change per se. I did stratospheric dynamics, which is relevant to the ozone hole. But absolutely, I was motivated by curiosity, and primarily. I mean, I was affected, though. I mean, as the story I just told you does indicate that some notion that the science I was doing was going to be relevant to society was part of it, but it wasn't really what brought me in. It was a question of just intellectual curiosity, and then you get into doing the work, and it's you know, you're trying to solve a problem. You get really motivated by that. You're learning something in research that nobody has known before, and that's very exciting. There's this kind of sense of discovery. In my career, as I've gotten older, though, and as the climate problem has gotten more acute, I do think more and more about the societal ramifications of what I'm doing, and that does start to motivate some of the work that I'm doing, because you get older and you're thinking about the future and your children, everybody else's children, and you know, what's the legacy you're leaving? And if you're in a field, not every field is like this, but if you're in a field where it does have big social ramifications, it is, you know, politically charged nowadays, I think it behooves scientists like me to think about how our work sits in that space and to try to reconcile, you know, make sure the science we're doing is contributing in some positive way to that.
Right. Right. Well, Adam, amazingly enough, we've run out of time, so to speak, and I appreciate so much you stopping by and talking with me today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Once again, this is Dave Cornelison for the web version of STEM Spots, signing off.
STEM Spots is available online at ksmu.org.